This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hello, welcome to this special AJ Bell Money and Markets podcast. I'm Dan Coatsworth, and with me this week to dissect the Chancellor's autumn statement is Danny Hewson. Hi there, Danny.
Hi, Dan. Yes, while most of Jeremy Hunt's measures were widely trailed in newspapers ahead of time, the big rabbit was that national insurance was cut by not 1%, but 2%. Full expensing for business was made permanent, and promises were made to bust the planning backlog.
Now, we're also joined in the studio this week by AJ Bell's pensions and savings expert, Charlene Young. Hi there, Charlene.
Hi, Dan and Danny. Yes, I'm going to talk about the fact that the state pension triple lock has been maintained. There's a push to deal with the problem of lost pension pots and some changes around the edges to ISAs.
We've also been keeping an eye on how markets have reacted to Jeremy Hunt's giveaways so far. And I think it's fair to say, meh.
I think that's probably a good, accurate description. But we will take a look at what's been happening on the markets in response to the autumn statement. And we'll also be taking a look at Nvidia, who's just released its latest results, of course, AI being one of the hot themes on the markets this year.
It is a hot theme, and if that's not enough to keep us going, we'll also bring you up to date, well, as much as we can, on the latest extraordinary goings-on at OpenAI, where Sam Altman is now back at the helm after a pretty incredible few days.
Should we try and make head of sense of what's going on with this autumn statement then? I mean, we are recording this literally just a few minutes after all the announcements made. We've had a quick go through all the documents, as best as we can, trying to make sense. I mean, I think I'll probably just summarise that, saying, you know, the UK economy is going to grow, but perhaps not as fast as people are thinking. Inflation's coming down, but it might take a bit longer to hit that 2% target than people thought. There's some good news for consumers and businesses in a sense, but I don't know. Danny, it just strikes me as being one of these sort of announcements where there's some good bits, but there's nothing to sort of jump up and down. What do you reckon?
It really felt like, in this case, the Chancellor was trying to give a bit of something to absolutely everybody, but not actually really giving anybody very much at all. You're right. I mean, growth, I think, is still the huge issue. It is the elephant in the room, isn't it? I mean, when we're talking about the OBR, it's downgraded its growth forecast for the next 3 years. We're only talking about 0.7% growth next year. And when we're talking about inflation, clearly, the headline rate has been coming down rapidly, and we've all got excited and we've jumped up and down. But then we're hearing that potentially inflation is not going to hit the 2% target till 2025. That is a long way away.
So, first thing will be, what does that mean for interest rates? Does that mean that inflation will be, you know, a problem for a while? Does that mean more interest rates hikes to come, or actually, what's, you know, have you had a look at what the market's been saying, Danny?
Yeah, so very, very, very tiny increase in expectation that we'll get another interest rate hike in December. I am talking about 2% more market expectation that we'll actually get to 5.5%. I think, to be honest with you, from what the Bank of England has been saying, and let's be fair, Andrew Bailey has been doing his absolute utmost to try and keep us all in check, to say, don't get carried away. Interest rate cuts are not worth talking about right now. We're not there yet. So I think, again, market reaction, it's the word of the day. Meh.
Yeah. I mean, so if we take a look at perhaps some what's been happening to individuals, I think heading up in towards this announcement, there was sort of lots of speculation about what could we have, income tax cuts, could we have something else? And of course, they've gone for national insurance cuts. So up until now, we've been paying 12% national insurance above earnings at just over £12,000 and up to just about £50,000. But of course, what the government's saying, thinking, well, you know, what can we do to try and help people? So they're going to cut national insurance rate to 10% from January 2024. So just to give you an idea of how that might impact your personal circumstances, someone on a salary of about £35,000 should save over £450 a year. If you're on £60,000, you're looking at about £750 savings. So if you think about a couple, both working, once they see these cuts to national insurance, together they could see up to £1,500 a year. I mean, so I guess, you know, we can't knock that really, can we? I mean, it's got to be a good thing. So there's also some stuff for self-employed as well. Cutting taxes there from April 2024. They're reducing the main rate of the Class 4 self-employed national insurance from 9 to 8% and going to scrap something called the Class 2 level. So what they're saying is together these changes will benefit about 2 million self-employed people and should save someone who's on, say, £28,000, about £350 a year. So again, this is all positive. What about business, though, Danny? What's been the key sort of takeaway there in terms of support?
Well, I think business certainly will be pleased that consumers are getting a bit more cash in their pockets. But I just have to point out with that, you know, when you look at the fact that the changes to national insurance for both employed people and self-employed people comes with a price tag of just under 10 billion quid. And yet, when you look at the 50 billion quid a year that the government is expected to make from freezing national insurance and those income thresholds, then you can just see this is very much a case of giving with one hand, but actually it's already been taken away with the other hand. So this is something that I think, despite as the naysaying, it's a little bit more in people's pockets, which clearly will be good for businesses. All they're saying is that they just want people to feel confident and to spend more. We also had what was trailed this morning as the biggest cut in business taxes. This is the extension to this full expensing, which allows people to invest and claim back 25 pence in the pound in that year. So this actually, it is pretty huge. The fact that it is now permanent, I think, is really important, because a lot of businesses were saying, look, you know, we're not able to plan properly. We're having to bring forward buying stuff before the deadline. But actually, what we really should be doing is thinking long term, thinking about buying much more expensive stuff, which takes 5 years to put in place, because that way it does create jobs. There was also some changes to planning that were announced. I know that there's been a huge issue in terms of the number of houses that have been built, and clearly a lot of house builders are waiting for interest rates to come down, for mortgage rates to come down, because that might then stimulate demand. But we are now at a point where, you know, demand, it's always out, supply, no, demand, I'm right, it is demand. Demand has always outstripped supply. However, you know, these companies, they're only going to build if they're going to make a decent amount of cash on it. And one of the big holdups has always been planning. So we know there's a big focus on that. There was also the extension of the retail, hospitality and leisure rates cut, which will help. And when we're talking about any kind of budget or autumn statement, the thing that always gets the headlines, fuel duty, alcohol duty, both staying where they are.
Yeah, I saw that there was, it's going to be more expensive if you're a smoker, but you know, if you're in, you know, into alcohol drinking, it should be fine. And I guess this is, it's good to be able to give support to businesses, particularly on the high street. I think that some of these have sort of seen quite tough times in the last few years, so it's very important to get that support. But the key thing here is that the national living wage is going up by 9.8% to £11.44 an hour. That's great news if you're on the national living wage, but not so if you're one of these sort of big employers like retailers or hospitality industry. Just think about the costs that they're going to have to incur, even more so. And you know, I saw some very sort of quick reactions from the hospitality industry yesterday when this was trailed ahead of the announcement. They're not happy at all, and you can understand why. So it just means that know, what will they do? They're going to have to pass it on extra costs of, you know, you're going to get a pie and a pint in a pub or a cafe or something. You know, you're going to have to probably expect to pay a little bit more. So I guess this is the typical, you know, government way of doing things. Like you say, they give give you one hand, something else is taken away somewhere else. So so yeah, I mean, it's all in all, yeah, it's fine. This is good, but nothing. I don't think there's anything particularly radical. And apart from, you know, the expense, full expensing thing is, I guess, like you say, long term positive. So.
But even that was a continuation. I think with this budget, we didn't see anything new. We didn't see any big new measures that will make a real difference. It was a lot more sort of more of the same, which, you know, when you're talking about a point where we are heading into an election, is that the narrative that they want?
It came across as sort of that they got things, that everything's on track. They've got this sort of agenda, this policy, these long-term targets and stuff, and they came away, you know, Jeremy Hunt was saying, you know, we're showing that we're making progress, and I think that's perhaps the message that they want. Maybe they've got some bigger rabbits to pull out the hat next for the budget next year. Of course, that'll be much closer to sort of campaign election time, so it might have been a calculated move.
Yeah, there was a lot of expectation I was hearing this morning with people saying, look, if we get an income tax cut, then we know that an election is going to happen within the next couple of months. If we don't, then that it's powder being kept dry for much closer to the time.
Yeah. So let's move on to pensions and ISAs. So Charlene's with us. So should we start with pensions first? So Charlene, what's the sort of the takeaways here? The triple lock has got to be the one to start with, isn't it?
So. Yeah, Dan, so to continue our theme of continuations, I think the triple lock increase to the state pension will be honoured, and so that will be an 8.5% increase to the state pension from April next year. So what does that mean for people getting the state pension? If you're on the new state pension, that's going to increase to just over £221 per week from April 2024. If you're on the old state pension, so that's paid to those who reached state pension age before the 6th of April 2016, that's going to increase too, and that will be to £169.50 per week. In terms of surprises, there was talk a lower inflation might be used than the 8.5% figure, but it's not a huge surprise. It does still feel like an independent review with some cross-party support is the long-term kind of sensible route forward to stop the uncertainty every year on state pensions. You know, we're talking about continuation of long-term plans here every year, or more than every year, it feels like we're talking about the triple lock, and it's just not sustainable for people to sort of plan their finances.
What about this idea that if you move to a new job, you might be able to convince your new employer to keep paying to the pension that you already have? Is that like a proposal or a firm rule that's coming into place?
Yeah, so again, something that we saw trailed over the last few days was this idea of a pot for life, or a pension pot for life. So what was announced is a consultation. So that's going to explore giving employees the right to ask their employer to pay their workplace pension contributions into an existing pension pot that they have, rather than the current setup of a default scheme chosen by the employer. What does it mean? I suppose for the more engaged pension savers, it will give them more flexibility as to how to invest their workplace pension money. It also aims to solve the problem of lost pensions, and that's estimated currently to be a value of £27 billion in lost pensions that people have picked up as they change jobs over the course of their lives. I think, of course, we support anything that helps get more people invested and take control of their finances at potentially lower costs. But realistically, it would be a huge headache and cost for employers under the current setup. It will require a lot of work on payroll systems, and that doesn't automatically translate to lower costs for all pension savers. So there's an argument perhaps this problem of lost pensions could be solved by bringing forward the implementation of pension dashboards and helping people with lost pension pots find them and get them into one lower cost scheme. I think we're just worried with lots of unanswered questions at the moment, and the work and expense required, it could be over before it begins, really.
Mm. Is there a danger with this as well, Charlene, that for people that aren't so engaged, that they might find actually that if they'd gone with the new workplace pension, it would have been better for them?
Yeah, so I think that there's There's a worry that whilst this will help people who are already engaged with their pensions, people who are happy with the default scheme or will stay in that will see this kind of drain of people leaving the workplace scheme. And like I say, it doesn't automatically mean that everybody will suddenly get access to a better pension scheme. So again, it is just a consultation. So perhaps I'm being a bit too negative about it, that they are asking questions and we will be going forward along with other pension providers giving representations. But again, there's a question mark over who's going to fund this setup and the sort of clearinghouses and payroll issues that will be needed. In terms of surprises, again, this was not a surprise today. One of many leaks of what might have been coming today that we've seen over the last few days, really. Just a question on pensions as well. I mean, these are the main two things we've picked out on pensions from the autumn statement. There's documents and new rules being published as we're talking to listeners today. So we may have more over the coming days to talk about.
What about ISAs then? I mean, it's quite interesting. We all sat around in the office watching the TV. I guess because of the nature of our job, we're very interested in to know what's happening with ISAs. And there was lots of sort of speculation in the weeks leading up to it. And not a single mention, but of course you jump straight into the actual documents when they're published. And it's quite a lot. So what are they sort of saying in terms of sort of potential changes with ISAs?
Yeah, certainly. I think we were all sort of left looking at each other going, did I miss that? Was there not something on ISAs in there? So nothing in the actual speech itself from Jeremy Hunt, but quite a bit in those documents from the Treasury that have just landed. So some important changes coming in from the 6th of April next year. So the annual ISA allowances are actually staying the same, but one change is that all adult ISAs will now only be available from age 18. Cash ISAs can actually be opened at the moment from age 16, which created this quite interesting loophole and opportunity for people where children could actually save £20,000 in a cash adult ISA at the ages of 16 and 17, but also still have a junior stocks and shares or investment junior ISA with that extra £9,000 allowance. So that kind of loophole is being closed. So the other changes are all looking at making ISAs a little bit more flexible. So getting rid of the rule that meant you could only pay into one ISA of the same type each tax year. You'll be able to transfer as much or as little of what you've paid into an ISA in the current tax year as you want. And we've been told certain fractional shares will be allowed. So at the moment, this is not permitted despite what some investment providers might be claiming. We aren't quite sure what it means yet in terms of the certain fractional shares. It's likely it could be bigger companies, but I've not seen anything myself on whether that will be UK or US at this stage.
I guess it's worth just in case anyone who's listening to this podcast is not quite sure what a fractional share is, it's probably worth an explanation, isn't it? So the idea of you might want to buy one of these big shares in these big American tech companies like, you know, Amazon and Tesla and stuff. If you ever go and look at how much a single share costs, sometimes they're hundreds or thousands of dollars just for a single share. And of course, a lot of people can't afford that. But the idea of, could you buy like a bit of a share, a fraction of a share? That's where this is coming from, isn't it? So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are investors who want to get started there with big brands that they're familiar with, like you've talked about. So it's about being able to buy this kind of fraction of a whole share that might be priced at quite a high level, particularly for kind of investors starting out. So at the moment, if you read the black and white of the rules, it's quite clear that it has to be whole shares. So this looks like, you know, the Treasury are looking at, you know, broadening the investment options available under those investment ISAs for investors who want to invest in these type of companies. Kind of finally, listeners might have heard about the long-term asset fund in the context of pensions and the Mansion House reforms. So we've seen that the innovative finance ISA will be expanded to allow investment into this long-term asset fund and some property funds from April 2024. So if you were one of those who wanted to get invested in a UK PLC, you'll be able to do that in that type of ISA. There will be no new Great British ISA or BRISA that we saw in the press in the last few weeks. I'm trying to say that with a straight face, apologies. So again, in terms of what we think, in terms of a surprise, it's not a surprise. This was on the cards. It was in the press in the last few days, but really it does not go far enough in our view. I've talked about changes around the edges or tinkering. You might have seen at AJ Bell, we've called for sort of radical simplification of ISAs into one ISA account rather than having all these different types of ISAs, you know, innovative finance, lifetime ISA, investment ISA. So yes, we'd like to see the changes to ISAs go a little bit further. But instead, we're seeing that investment into UK PLC via the innovative finance ISA rather than the introduction of a new type. So whilst it's not the wholesale change we're looking for, at least it's not another new type of ISA.
Thank you, Charlene. I tell you what, while we're talking about getting people investing for the first time, let's talk about NatWest. And in the autumn statement, it was really interesting. People listening might have been going, who's Sid? What are you talking about? You know, what is it about getting Sid investing again? Well, it relates to an advertising campaign when British Gas was sold off back in the 1980s. And it was famously, tell Sid. It was all about an opportunity to get an average guy on the street to get his hands or her hands on some of the spoils with these huge institutional companies being made private. And of course, NatWest is still owned, considerable chunk of it, by the taxpayer. And the idea now seems to be that 38.6% is going to be offloaded to retail investors in a share offer. And clearly this is something which Jeremy Hunt hopes is going to get people really interested and, you know, maybe wanting to get involved.
I thought it was, this is slightly different than the sort of the privatizations we saw in the 80s, because that time these companies weren't on the stock market. NatWest is already on the stock market. There's nothing to stop you or I going to buy these shares today. But so it means that the government is going to have to launch a campaign and sell those shares, because don't forget it owns just under 40% of the whole business still. It's going to have to sell those shares below market value in order to shift it, because that's a sizable amount of stock to offload. Of course, it goes back to the global financial crisis. You know, £46 billion was spent by taxpayers bailing out NatWest when it was called Royal Bank of Scotland. Share price today, it's kind of no real difference to where it was in 2009. So I don't know. It's not this. I can't see this being a huge rush of people sort of saying, okay, that's brilliant. I really want to buy NatWest, but it's all in how much discount they can get. Because if you go back to British Gas privatisation, approximately 1.5 million people took part in that campaign to take part and buy those shares. Big chunk of them flipped them as soon as they could. So I guess this is what people might be able to do it. But like you say, it could be an opportunity if the government spends enough money on, you know, making this campaign visible to people, that this could be the first time people invest. And, you know, I guess in the long-term scheme of things, that's got to be a good thing to get people involved in something. So let's see where it goes.
And this is certainly a huge household name. You know, you see it on high street. So just like you were talking about those Amazons, Apple, Teslas, this is a company, a business, a bank that people are familiar with. And if you're talking about getting investing for the first time, a lot of the time it is with the familiar, isn't it? Yeah. Let's just talk then about how markets overall reacted to what we saw from the autumn statement. As I said earlier, it was pretty meh.
Yeah, I mean, interesting that the pound was down, and I think that's probably due to sort of these lower growth forecasts for the UK. NatWest share price immediately fell as soon as the government said it was going to do this campaign, but then it sort of slightly ticked up again, because I think the government's sort of saying we're going to do this potentially within the next 12 months. If it had said we're going to do this in the next few weeks, then I would have thought that NatWest share price would have fallen considerably more. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, you know, the FTSE 250, about half of that index sort of generates income from the UK, sort of domestic focus, barely moved. So I think that sort of says it all. There wasn't really anything radical to sort of to make investors rush to buy particular sectors or particular stocks. And so I guess we'll have to keep an eye on where gilt yields have been going. They've been falling in the last few weeks on the assumption that we've hit the interest rate peak in terms of the hikes. But I guess now, if you're saying that inflation might take a bit longer to hit the sort of the 2% target, potential, and there's a slight increase in expectations for interest rate hikes, potentially gilts might sort of sort of move up again in terms of the yields. But in general, there isn't really anything, any sort of major takeaways.
No, I think it was quite interesting. We were watching what was going on quite closely because we all remember what happened just over a year ago after that Kwasi Kwarteng Liz Truss budget. But I think, you know, volatility has been the hallmark of this entire year, really. And it's not just big fiscal events like the autumn statement that can have huge impacts, but also when we get some of these big companies reporting, they can make massive waves. And at the moment, there really isn't a company capable of making waves in quite the same way as Nvidia is. There was a lot of expectation when it put its results out that it was going to keep on smashing it. Has it?
Well, a 250% share price gain this year basically says investors who've backed this have done incredibly well. And it's because the company's been growing fast. It's seen as like the ultimate way to play artificial intelligence. It comes out with these third quarter results that almost across the board better than expected. You'd naturally expect the share price to rise, but that's not what happened. It sort of dipped straight away. And thinking, what on earth is going on here? And I just think this is one of these businesses where unless it does something absolutely extraordinary and completely smashes forecasts, investors get a bit grumpy. And to me, I had a quick look, and there was the key thing there is China. Now, the US government sort of imposed export control regulations on sort of chips. And of course, now Nvidia's saying, you know, we make about 20% of our sales from that country. Next quarter, you're going to have to expect these sales to decline significantly. So the share price fell on that. And I think people were sort of worried because perhaps they don't realize that, that perhaps Nvidia's got so much reliance on that part of Asia. There was also a slight miss with the free cash flow, but I think overall, if you look at the sort of what the company's talking about, and you can actually access the transcript quite easily online of the conference call with analysts, they're really excited. This seems like a real turning point for technology sector. You know, so many companies, multiple industries, are looking at artificial intelligence to help improve efficiency, make them more productive. So, you know, you can see considerable investment over the coming years. And of course, Nvidia's got no real competition of scale. And so, you know, as long as the company keeps finding opportunities, keeps innovating, and it's launching a real big new AI chip in the new year, I would have thought this will stay a real favorite with investors, even though the share price hasn't exploded once again off these latest results.
Now, while we're talking about AI, and I'm aware that we've been rumbling on for quite some time now, but we couldn't end this particular podcast without talking about OpenAI and the absolute absurdity of what has happened over the course of 5 days. I was astonished to hear on Friday that Sam Altman had been sacked completely out of the blue. Microsoft, which is one of the major shareholders, didn't seem to know anything about it. And there was a massive hoo-ha on social media. You had the majority of staff, over 750 of the 770 staff, calling for the board to resign, for him to be reinstated, and the former president, Greg Brockman, also to be reinstated as well. He actually quit after he was stripped of his position on the board. And then just after 6 o'clock this morning, there is a tweet from OpenAI saying, we've reached an agreement in principle for Sam Altman to return to OpenAI. Now, he'd already got another job. You know, Microsoft had already pulled him in the fold because clearly they didn't want to see their investment impacted. There are still huge questions about what prompted his sacking in the first place. What was going on? What is the miscommunication? What is his big push that the board did not like? You know, we know AI has the potential to be absolutely incredible for humankind, to deliver those kind of advances that you were just talking about. But also, there are big concerns about its potential to do harm and the need for guardrails to be put in place. And you have to remember that OpenAI is a non-profit organization. it was set up, you look on its website, it is all about making the case to look after society, not to innovate at any cost, not to innovate just because it wants to please its investors, but to make sure that what is being done benefits humanity. So this has been a bonkers period of time. I mean, we've seen founders come and go before. You know, I think of Steve Jobs. You know, he was fired from Apple in the 1980s before coming back and doing incredible things. But it was less than sort of 5 days that he was out of the office for, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting story. And so let's wrap things up now. Thank you ever so much for listening to this very quick reaction to the autumn statement. I hope you found it useful. Next week, we're going to have the first in a sort of series of the next couple of weeks of getting some fund managers on, talking about how they found the year and what they're looking for in the year ahead. So till then, thank you very much for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you whether certain investments are suitable or not. And don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that tax rules apply, and that the way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.